Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
California has Lassen County, Lassen Peak, Lassen National Volcanic Park, Lassen National Forest, Lassen College, and many streets and schools named Lassen. But who was this Lassen, whose name is all over the map in Northern California? Librarian Nancy Leek answers this question in her latest biography for children. She has worked in public school and academic libraries and has now written a fourth biography, illustrated by Steve Fershad, award-winning illustrator of over 30 books. I'll first ask Nancy Leek about her newest book, Peter Lassen, The True Story of a Danish Pioneer in California. Then we'll hear what he has to say about Peter Lassen's friend, John Bidwell, who said, "Peter is a singular man, very industrious, very ingenious, and very fond of pioneering." Nancy Leek, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I never knew much about Peter Lassen. I see his name all over the map. But I did not know his background, and I found it really interesting. What got you interested in Peter Lassen?
Well, I've been doing this series of picture book biographies for children. The first was on John and Annie Bidwell, then one on Nancy Kelsey, and then I thought, Peter Lassen. Everybody knows the name Lassen in Northern California, but most people don't know who he was, why he was here, what he did. I thought it would make a great story.
Well, part of it was he seems like a loner. He's quite happy out by himself.
That's true.
And so not a lot of people could say, well, here's what my experience was with Peter Lassen, because he was out by himself so much of the time.
There's very little on Lassen. There's been a couple good books written about him, but he left no letters. Well, there's a handful of letters that say, you know, send 200 pounds of flour or something like that. But there's really no letters, no autobiography, no memoir. There's very little material to go on. From him himself, there's nothing from him. There is some from Bidwell and from a man named Jay Goldsboro Bruff, who was a 49er who came over the Lassen Trail and he obsessively kept a journal and drew pictures, too. He's a very valuable resource, and he knew Lassen.
Well, because I was imagining when you, now your illustrator I mentioned is Steve Fershad. He's
yes.
A very experienced illustrator. And so I assume that you two kind of put your heads together and say, okay, here's how I see these pictures. But you didn't have much to go on like you did in some of your other books.
Well, that's true. There's one and only one portrait of Peter Lassen. There are drawings, though, by Bruff, who saw his ranch and so forth. That's helpful. And there's a grizzly bear in here, because I always like to get a grizzly bear in my book.
Well, your cover, like I say, this is illustrated by Steve Fershad, shows Peter Lassen on horseback, and he looks just like you would expect a pioneer to look. Now, in the one picture that you have, did you have any idea of what he wore that you could have Steve draw on the cover of your book?
Not really. Because it's just a portrait, it's not a full figure. And besides, people in those portraits usually dressed up. It wasn't what they would wear out on the trail. So we put him in typical 19th century clothing.
And then what is in the background? In the foreground, there's Peter Lassen on horseback. And in the background
is Lassen Peak.
As you might, it seems appropriate.
Yes.
Well, the title of your book, Peter Lassen, The True Story of a Danish Pioneer in California. And since he has a hat on the cover, we don't really see as much of him as we do on the first page. And I assume that Steve drew this first page from the one photograph
yes.
that you have.
Yes. That's based on the one portrait of him. That's what he looked like.
Well, let's hear the beginning of your story, which you say you have a picture, an illustration of this fairly young man looking out over, what is he looking at?
He's looking at Copenhagen Harbor. He was born near Copenhagen, and we had an exchange student from Denmark at one time. So I contacted him and said, I need to know what it looked like then so I can tell Steve. And his father, Christian's father, was very helpful and sent me a number of pictures of what the harbor looked like, because Copenhagen was a great shipping port. It still is.
But what did it look like in the 19th century?
Yes, absolutely. So we tried to get as close as we could to what it would have looked like then. I wanted it to be as accurate and authentic as possible.
Well, I know you do enjoy research.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting where that took you and who you rely on as your source for this first page illustration.
Yes, yes. And the second page, too, of the farmhouses, because there are pictures of the village where he came from.
Well, let's hear about Peter Lassen.
All right, I'll start with the beginning. Peter Lassen looked out over the ships in the harbor of Copenhagen. He longed to board one of those ships and travel, but he could not just get on a ship and go. To leave Denmark, he would need the permission of King Frederick. He would need money, too. But he knew that one day he would travel far beyond his home in Denmark. Peter Lassen was born in the little village of Farum, near the capital city of Copenhagen. His father was a farm worker named Lars Nielsen. In that place and time, a child's last name was based on his father's first name. Peter was the son of Lars, so his last name would be Larsen. Since Lasse is a nickname for Lars, he was also called Peter Lassen, and that's the name we know him by today. And he pronounced it Lawson.
Lawson.
We pronounce it Lassen, but he pronounced it Lawson.
How do we know that?
Well, because he shows up occasionally in other people's accounts, and often they will spell it Lawson.
Uh-huh. Well, I found this particularly interesting because I do know I had a neighbor whose last name was Nielsen, and I knew that they did that, but the word like son of Neil, son of Lars, but I didn't know that about Peter Lassen's name.
And they still do that in Iceland, as you know, but it was the way they were still doing things in all the Scandinavian countries up to a more recent time than Lassen's. And then, do you want me to continue reading? Or?
Yeah. And on this page is the sketch that Steve Fershaw did of this village near Copenhagen, where our hero, Peter Lassen, grew up. And Steve has him standing there in a garden with his father standing there with a hoe. We assume that's
yes,
his father.
Yes.
And then, now he's still just a youngster. He's not even out of his teens. So yeah, continue the story, Nancy.
When Peter was 17, he began working for his uncle, who was a blacksmith. He learned how to make horseshoes, nails, farm tools, iron rims for wagon wheels, and all kinds of metal work. After 5 years, he tied up all his tools in a sack and set out for Copenhagen to earn his living as a blacksmith. For another 5 years, he worked at the trade until he became a master blacksmith. But being a master blacksmith didn't mean that good business came his way. Perhaps there were too many blacksmiths in Copenhagen. Peter found it hard to earn a living. He wanted a new start in a new world. He wrote a letter to the king asking permission to immigrate to America. The king gave his permission, and Peter sailed away.
So we have him leaving his native Denmark.
Yes, he was 30
by then. Yes, and he'd been wanting to do that since he was a teenager.
I think so.
So meanwhile,
he was a restless, wandering sort of man.
So when he gets to his 30s, he leaves Copenhagen, and Steve has drawn in his illustration, has a sailing ship arriving in Boston.
He went to Boston first, but I don't think he liked the big city. He went pretty soon. He kept going west. He spent several years in Missouri. And
Steve has him doing his blacksmithing trade there in Missouri.
Yeah. You could always get a job on the frontier if you were a blacksmith.
Well, then Steve has these little dotted lines showing him continuing west, and he's with some other people.
He joined a group of fur trappers who were going west, and he went out to Oregon. But he seems to have had his goal as California. It was 1839, because in Oregon he got on a ship and went down to California.
My guest is Nancy Leake. She is a librarian by profession, a historian by avocation. And her latest biography for children is Peter Lassen, The True Story of a Danish Pioneer in California. And Nancy, I find your books fascinating, and I'm way beyond children's age or even teenagers. So I can just imagine mother and dad reading these stories to their children. Do you get any feedback about that?
I do sometimes, yes. A lot of grown-ups enjoy them because sometimes that's all you want to know about somebody. And I always put in the back a couple pages of more information because I know that teachers or parents may want, you know, more information about this person. And I like to put in a bibliography because if they're interested in reading more, there are other books to go to. And I like to show where I got my information.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's continue then. After Peter landed in Boston and that he didn't really like living in a big city, so continue there if you would.
Peter landed in Boston. Living in a big city did not suit him. He wanted to see America beyond the muddy streets and tall houses of a crowded city. He wanted elbow room. He set out across America until he reached Missouri. For the next few years, he lived and worked in the small town of Catesville. Missouri was on the edge of the American frontier. Beyond it lay wide, open prairies where great herds of buffalo were hunted by the Indians of the plains. Further west were mountains, deserts, more mountains, and the Pacific Ocean. That would be worth seeing. In 1839, Peter joined a band of fur trappers traveling to Oregon. From Oregon, he went by ship to California. He landed at Fort Ross, where the Russians had an outpost. From there, he went to Monterey to ask the Mexican government to let him stay in California. He learned that John Sutter had a ranch on the American River. Sutter, who was from Switzerland, could probably use a blacksmith.
And there you get in a hint that didn't belong to the United States when Peter Lassen arrived.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
So he has to get permission from the Mexican government to let him stay in California.
Right, right.
And then you go on to say California was a land claimed by Mexico.
The Mexicans, with their ranchos and missions, lived near the coast. When John Sutter asked for land, he was allowed to settle inland at the bottom of the Sacramento Valley. There he began to raise cattle and horses and grow wheat. But to build a ranch, he needed people. Lots of people, doing all kinds of jobs. Peter Lassen, the blacksmith, was just the kind of man he needed. And that's where he met John Bidwell.
Because he went to work for John Sutter.
Right, right. Sutter was always looking for, I mean, he had vaqueros and he had Indian workers, but he was always looking for men who had skills. And both of these men did.
And Steve Fershot has made a sketch of these two guys looking out over the land with a plan. And you can just imagine John Sutter saying to Peter Lassen, here's what I have in mind.
Right. And Sutter himself had only just gotten there in 1839.
I'm here with librarian and historian Nancy Leek. We're talking about her latest biography of pioneer Peter Lassen. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Today, we're taking a look back at a pioneer from Denmark, Peter Lassen, whose name is all over maps in Northern California.
Peter made another friend at Sutter's Fort. His name was John Bidwell. One spring day in 1843, Peter and John set out to ride up the Sacramento Valley. They were chasing after a group of travelers who had taken John's horse and mule. John wanted to get his animals back, and Peter went along to help him. It was a chance to see somewhere he hadn't been yet, and Peter always liked to see new places. As they traveled near the Sacramento River, they spied 16 grizzly bears feeding in the tall grass. Peter loved to hunt, but he knew that grizzlies are dangerous. There were too many bears for the men to hunt them safely. Peter and John chased after the largest bear, but they didn't try to shoot him. This time, they were just enjoying the chase.
And how did you know about this? And of course, Steve Frechette has sketched a grizzly bear there, big as life there on this page. But how did you know about this incident?
This comes from John Bidwell. He contributed to the history of Colusa County and describes his exploration of the Sacramento Valley. And this is where both Peter Lassen and John Bidwell found the ranches that they wanted, the land they wanted to settle on.
Well, this earns credibility with those of us here in the 21st century to say, oh, good, they didn't kill that grizzly bear.
Well, they did kill plenty of grizzly bears, which is why we don't have them in California now, except on the flag. There were grizzlies everywhere, and because they were top of the food chain and there was plenty to eat. But, they were pretty much hunted to extinction in California. They finally found the travelers, and John got his horse and mule back. Better yet, Peter and John both found places where they wanted to live. Peter chose a piece of land along Deer Creek, where it ran into the Sacramento River. He asked the Mexican government to give him a ranch there. Peter had plenty of ideas for his ranch. He would raise cattle and horses. He would grow his own food, wheat and oats and fruits and vegetables. He would have everything he needed right there on his ranch. Peter made friends with the natives who lived on this land. He hired these Indians to work for him. They built a house, a blacksmith shop, a stable for the horses, and corrals for the animals. They cut trees for building and for firewood. In the fields, they planted wheat, cotton, and grapevines. Fremont is the one who mentions cotton, that he tried to grow cotton. Find all sorts of interesting details.
Well, the next sketch, after this, his buildings and horses, you have two guys working on, it looks like, this huge stone. What are they doing there?
They're making millstones from Stony Creek over in Glenn County. Like Bidwell said, Lassen was industrious, he was ingenious, and he would turn his hand to anything. He knew there was a need for millstones and whetstones to sharpen knives and to grind wheat. And so he thought, okay, here's some stones. I can turn these into millstones.
Well, you do then say, you have Steve's sketch there of these two men working on a stone, and continue there.
Peter built a mill for grinding wheat into flour. And at that time, the kind of mill he was building was the kind the Mexicans used, which was just an animal, a donkey maybe, or a mule, pulling the bar around and around and around to grind the wheat.
You might like to add that where we're sitting right now in the studios of North State Public Radio is not far from John Bidwell's mill.
That's true. Bidwell built a mill right here on Chico Creek. And eventually, I think Peter Lassen built a mill on his land, but because Deer Creek would have provided the water power. But I'm not sure about that.
Well, he did make the stones, though, so continue
yes.
Your story.
A mill needs two grindstones to crush the wheat, and Peter knew where to find stones that would make good grindstones. He also knew that other people would want grindstones. They would want whetstones for sharpening knives, too. He went west to Stony Creek and found stones the right size. He and his friend chipped and carved until they had big stones for grinding wheat and smaller stones for sharpening knives. They put several stones in a boat and floated down the Sacramento River to sell their stones. Lassen's ranch was such a beautiful place to live. Peter was sure that other folks from the United States would want to come and live in California. He wanted to make a town around his ranch. He decided to go back to Missouri and gather people to settle alongside him. And he wanted to name it Bentonville, after Senator Thomas Hart Benton from Missouri. And in honor, that was Fremont's father-in-law. His plans for a town did not work out. In the summer of 1847, Peter traveled back to Missouri. He spent the winter visiting with friends. He was looking for people who wanted to go to California. In May 1848, he set out to lead a group of men and women in 12 wagons to California. They traveled along the Oregon-California Trail, the same trail other pioneers had taken to the West. The wagon train crossed prairies and rivers and mountains until it reached the desert, where it followed the Humboldt River. About September 1st, the wagon train came to a large grassy meadow. Here, Peter's wagon train left the California Trail and headed north on the Applegate Trail to Oregon.
And then people were always trying to find a good way to get from, say, Missouri into California, because it was a difficult route.
There was no good way to get into California. There's deserts, there's mountains. And Lassen, when he traveled back, going to Missouri in 1847, he went over Donner Pass. And he hadn't come in that way. He went back over the Sierras, and he saw what had happened to the Donner Party in 1846. And that's why I think, he thought, this is too risky. This is not safe. I've got to find a better way to get my people back to California. And so that's why he developed the Lassen Trail, which went north and then back down south. It went through the Cascade Range. The mountains weren't as high. It took longer. It wasn't really any easier, but there wasn't any easy way.
And people were always looking, including Peter Lassen. My guest is Nancy Leake. She is a librarian, and she writes biographies for school-age children. The one, her most recent one now, is Peter Lassen, the story of a Danish pioneer in California. And he came to California. He wants to go back to Missouri to get people to come join him here in California. But he is stymied by having a good route that he couldn't come up with a good way of getting to California.
Well, he developed the Lassen Trail, and that was used by a fair number of people during the gold rush.
Well, you say sometimes it was easier because there weren't these high mountains to cross if they took Lassen, the trail named for him. And then pick up there where you say sometimes Peter took a wrong turn.
Sometimes Peter took a wrong turn and had to try another way. It was really difficult. His followers had no choice except to struggle on through canyons, past a snowy, sleeping volcano, and down steep ridges into the valley. That volcano would later be named for Peter Lassen. Today, we call it Lassen Peak or Mount Lassen, but strictly speaking, it's Lassen Peak.
Well, then, while Peter was gone, he comes back. He gets back to his ranch in December of 1848, and that should kind of ring a bell with people.
Yes. Meanwhile, back at the ranch.
Literally back at the ranch.
Gold had been discovered in California. He had some other friends living on the ranch. I think they'd all left. Everybody's going looking for gold. No one wants to settle on Lassen's ranch. They all want to go hunting for gold.
So you have more people coming over Lassen Trail because we've had a gold rush in 1849.
Right. And Lassen's ranch was a well-known place to stop, rest. You could get food. He was very generous. He was very generous to travelers. He was a friendly guy. I mean, on the one hand, he was kind of a loner. But on the other hand, he was generous, outgoing, hospitable.
Well, you say that everyone learned that old Pete was a good neighbor and a good friend.
Yes.
So then everybody else is going looking for gold. So what does Pete do?
Well, he decides he'll go too. And everybody had heard that up in the mountains there was a gold lake where there were just nuggets for the picking, you know, all around, scattered around the lake. And he thought, oh, find Gold Lake. That'll be great. And he never was successful at finding gold at all. Evidently, there was no gold lake. Lots of people looked for it. And I thought it was really interesting that he found this Indian who drew him a map. But the way he made the map was to lay out a big piece of leather on the ground, put on sand and dirt and mountains, you know, for mountains and rocks, and use a straw to draw streams. it's not a map you could pick up and roll up and take with you. But
no, it's not portable. If you have sand on leather, you can't very well put that in your pocket and follow.
Right. But he, you know, he studied that map and he thought they spent the summer exploring. They never found Gold Lake.
You say even though he didn't find Gold Lake, that Peter was happy roaming around the mountains.
He loved pioneering.
So where did he settle?
Well, you know, he had his ranch, but gradually he lost the ranch. He was cheated out of some of it. He finally sold off the last of it. He wasn't the kind of man Bidwell was, you know, who was very organized and on top of things. He was more interested in exploring and hunting and trailblazing. So he sold the last of the ranch and moved up to Indian Valley, just a lovely spot. And he had a trading post there with a friend.
Then Steve Rashad shows Peter Lassen sitting by a fire, just leaning back. And then on the next page, he's shaking hands with somebody who looks like an Indian, but is dressed rather distinctively.
Yeah, that's Chief Numaga, the chief of a band of Paiutes. He was very friendly with the Indians. He got along well with the Indians, and he did get along with this Chief Numaga, who was also known as Young Winnemucca.
Well, you have Peter Lassen and shaking hands with this Indian, and you said as long as Peter was alive, the white settlers and the Paiute Indians were good neighbors. And then what happens in 1959, 10 years after the gold rush?
1859. It's 1859. Yeah, there's gold discovered in Nevada.
You mean silver?
Silver. Mm-hmm. Well, I think there may have been some gold too, but yeah, you're right, it's silver. And maybe he was going to strike it rich at last, right? So he took two companions with him, two men, and they set out to prospect in the Black Rock Desert, which is along the Lassen Trail. He was familiar with the area.
So off they go, and he's hoping to discover silver since he wasn't successful in discovering gold. And then early one morning,
as the men lay sleeping in their blankets by their burnt-out campfire, a shot rang out. Wyatt, that's one of the men, jerked awake and found that the man next to him, Ed Clapper, had been shot dead. He called out to Lassen. Peter jumped to his feet. As he sprang up, he too was shot and killed. Wyatt dashed for his horse, leaped on its back, and escaped. Riding all day and night, Wyatt took the news back to Susanville. Mystery surrounds the murder of Peter Lassen. Wyatt claimed Paiute Indians shot Lassen. Chief Numaga denied that story. Peter Lassen was one of the best men he had ever known. He said they had slept in the same blanket. He would not let his people kill his friend. Other people thought the killings were done by white men, perhaps another prospecting group. Wyatt himself was suspected of murdering his two partners. To this day, no one knows for sure what happened at that lonely camp in the desert.
That is so shocking, Nancy. We're reading along. This guy has a nice life, and he's going having nice adventures. And all of a sudden, his life comes to an end in a shocking way.
Yes, and it's a mystery. It's a mystery. Yeah. No one knows to this day who was responsible.
And so on the last page of your book, you say,
with sorrowful hearts, Peter Lassen's friends went to the desert and brought his body back to his home. Old Pete, a man they had admired and loved and trusted, was dead. They buried him under the great pine tree where he had camped on his first night in Honey Lake Valley. And if you go to Susanville, just outside of Susanville, you can see his gravesite. There are actually two monuments there. The one in the picture is the original.
The one that Steve Rashad sketched.
Yes, that's the original. It's under
monument.
A shelter now because it was deteriorating. And then they erected a new, higher monument next to that. He was well beloved in his part of the country.
That's such a fascinating story, Nancy.
It is.
Thank
it
you
is.
For writing this. And you write biographies that are so interesting of these people who were pioneers here in California. And I'm looking forward to what you might choose to write next.
I'm not sure what I'll do next. But if anybody wants to give me an idea, I'm open.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
historian Nancy Leek, who by profession is a librarian, but she writes biographies for children. And today we've been listening to a recounting of the life of Peter Lassen. And she also wrote a book about John Bidwell. They happen to know each other. And we're looking at these two pioneers today on Nancy's Bookshelf. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf here on North State Public Radio. Today's guest has written biographies for children illustrated by award-winning illustrator Steve Forshad. Her latest book is Peter Lassen, The True Story of a Danish Pioneer in California, and she also wrote a book on John Bidwell. John Bidwell, The Adventurous Life of a California Pioneer.
I wanted to write a book that would be a good solid introductory biography to Bidwell.
So you make a trip to Minnesota, I believe it was, and you, under your arm, you tucked a copy of?
Well, Mike Gillis and Mike Magliari wrote a book in 2002, John Bidwell in California. And it is an excellent book, but it's pretty lengthy and academic, so it's not for the casual reader. And I took that along, that and a pencil, and I sat down, you know, when I wasn't having fun with the grandkids, I sat down and read through it and thought, wow, there's a lot of material here. He had a fascinating life. And so I knew there was plenty to write about with John Bidwell.
So you decide to write this book, and you had one source, the local authors here in Chico that had written this book that was aimed at a more intellectual level, perhaps. But you have such wonderful detail in there about what John Bidwell was like as a 7-year-old. How did you uncover these little gems of information about him?
Well, Bidwell told his story more than once. He wrote especially about his trek across the plains and the gold rush and that era, the Mexican War. He wrote a lot about that. He wrote something that was actually, I think it was dictated, but it was for the Century magazine that was a very popular magazine in the 1880s, 90s, and he wrote a 3-part series for them. That's called Echoes of the Past, and that's in print. You can get that at Bidwell Mansion, for instance. But he was also interviewed twice not by Hubert Howe Bancroft, but Bancroft sent out people to interview various California old-timers. And Bidwell was interviewed twice and told that same story again. And a lot of these stories come from the interview he did in 1891, The Dictation, which has never been put into print, I don't think. But it's over there at Chico State, and it's got stories about his boyhood and his experiences as a young man, as well as a lot about politics, because, of course, he was very involved in California politics and national politics, too.
Well, there was a sentence in your book, and you wrote it when you were talking about the fact that he decided he wanted to plant grapevines on his property and fig trees and other fruit trees. And so he traveled 1,200 miles to get these fruit trees. And the sentence you wrote was, John Bidwell, I don't remember the exact wording, didn't mind traveling great distances to get what he wanted. And I thought back to the very opening story you told when John Bidwell was 7 years old. And he, at that time, what he wanted as a 7-year-old, the steamboat was going to be launched on Lake Erie.
He wanted to see a steamboat. That was so exciting. Everybody was going to see this steamboat be launched. And they had a farm near the shores of Lake Erie, at that time, and he wanted to go so badly, and his mother couldn't take him. There were younger brothers and sisters. His father was working somewhere else, and so he snuck out of the house, down the road. He was hoping to catch a ride on a wagon, but he ended up having to walk 7 miles to see the steamboat. But he was there for the launch, and then he got a ride home with a neighbor's wagon, you know, and he spent the whole day out there. People, everybody walked everywhere back then, of course, but then he ended up walking to, well, they moved to Ohio. He walked from one side of the Ohio to the other to just to get an education.
And that's another thing that I admired about him was how he valued education. And in this case, like you say, he was willing to go on foot back to this Kingsville Academy mm-hmm. where he went to school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he ended up being a better educated man than most of the immigrants to California.
In fact, you know what? I think people will be surprised that after a year at this Kingsville Academy, he was qualified then to be a teacher himself.
Oh, yes. And he did. He taught school for a couple years. One of my favorite stories about him is that, you know, he settled in Missouri. He staked a claim there. And during the summer, he had some spare time. So he decided to take a steamboat down to St. Louis and get some clothes and some books. He was always looking for books because very much he was a self-taught man. And one of the things he acquired was an astronomy book, a little handbook of astronomy with an accompanying celestial atlas, which was a larger book. And he took those back, you know, to his claim and found out that a squatter had jumped his claim. And so then, you know, he had no land.
He was only 20 years old.
He was only 21
to actually be able to claim that land, didn't he?
Exactly. He had no legal claim to the land because he wasn't quite 21 yet. So that's when he decided to go to California. But that astronomy book and the celestial atlas, he carried with him all the way across the plains, across the desert, across the Sierras, and it's now in the State Library. I put a picture of it in mm-hmm. the book because that just fascinated me, how much he valued that knowledge. They abandoned their wagons. They kept leaving things behind. They had less and less items they could carry as they struggled to cross the Sierras, and yet he never abandoned those books.
Mm-hmm. He tossed out anything else, but he didn't toss out those books.
Exactly.
And I think that's a good thing for children to know that somebody like him valued books so much that even when he had to carry it in without a wagon, he was walking on foot and wanted to, among the few possessions he was willing to carry were these books.
Exactly.
And so I think that's of interest. These things that you bring out, like what, as a 7-year-old, when he wanted to see the steamship, he was willing to walk. And then when he became, so I think these are the things that would interest a young reader, what John Bidwell was like as a 7-year-old, and also school children to know what John Bidwell was like as a teacher, because I don't think they realized in those days, if you misbehaved, you would get a whipping.
Not John Bidwell. Former students of his reported that he would never whip a student, and yet he had excellent control of his class. And I don't know exactly how he did it. He never said anything about that. But somehow he managed to keep them interested enough where he didn't have to resort to whipping or beating his students, which was standard practice in those days.
That's how you maintain discipline.
Exactly.
Except he didn't do it that way. Well, I'm just the more I know about John Bidwell, the more I admire him. I'm talking to Nancy Leake about her book, John Bidwell, The Adventurous Life of a California Pioneer. And she wrote this for young readers. But you know what, Nancy? Because I find him such an interesting person, as soon as I got your book, I opened it, started reading. And it wasn't until I had read a few pages that I turned it over and saw the quote from your professor friend whose book you read.
Mm-hmm. And Mike Magliari.
Yes. And he says it's this need for a local history book suitable for young readers. I thought, oh, I didn't even notice it was aimed at young readers because I was so engrossed in it as an adult that I hadn't noticed that, well, yeah, this is something that young readers could read too.
You know, I took as my model for how I wrote this book a book that came out in the 80s, Russell Friedman's Lincoln, a Photobiography, which won the Newbery Medal, because it was the model for a new kind of biography for young readers. No fictionalized dialogue, no fictionalized incidents, and no skirting around the controversial issues either. told in a way that's accessible and interesting to young people, but still can also be interesting to adults. Makes a good short biography. And that's the way biographies for young people are being written now. Those are the best ones. And there are some great ones being written. And I wanted to do that kind of book.
Yeah, I like the fact that you included a lot of photographs, but also that you included maps. Because I really, no matter what book I'm reading, if they're talking about places, I like to know where one place relates to another. How far, when he was making this trek across the country, how far was one place from another? Where was it that half the gang decided, well, we're not going that way because you guys don't know where you're going? So I like the fact that you had these maps.
Oh, you have to have maps in a book like this, yeah.
Well, I think so, too. And speaking of the fact that some of them said, we're going to head north here. You guys keep heading west. That is just, I think people, and probably young people, would be amazed that here this group of people start out and say, yeah, we're going to California. 500 people, we're going to California. And then John Bidwell turns around to look over his shoulder, and they had all disappeared. And there he was. Oh, all right, so now what?
Yeah, there had been this enthusiasm for California, which was very new. They just started having rumors about, there's this really nice place out there called California. And he organized this Western Immigration Society, and a lot of people joined up, said they were going to go. And a lot of this enthusiasm was based on letters that Dr. John Marsh had written. He was living in California. He wrote back to newspapers. These letters were published in newspapers saying how wonderful it was. And they also heard some tales from a fur trapper, too. And then some other contradictory letters came out saying, the Mexican government, they don't necessarily want you here. And most people gave up. But Bidwell had made that decision. He wasn't going to go back to Ohio because he didn't want to go back as a failure. He was a man who was looking for success. And if he couldn't succeed in Missouri, well, he was going to try someplace else, maybe California. So about 60 people got together in this group, and they had not a clue how to get to California other than it was west. Now, today, we would not go anywhere without maps, GPS, all this stuff. But they didn't have a map. And the map he had seen a map, and it showed two large rivers flowing across the Great Basin all the way to the Pacific. Maybe they were going to build boats. And, of course, they didn't exist at all. Even the maps weren't accurate, but they didn't have one anyway.
So they just were lucky. Follow the setting sun.
Yeah, follow the setting sun. They were lucky enough to hook up with another group, a missionary group. Catholic missionary Father Jean-Pierre de Smet was going to the Northwest area to teach the Indians. And he had hired a mountain man as a guide, a fur trapper named Thomas Fitzpatrick. And these two groups got together, and that might have been, their salvation, because they learned how to be these travelers as they went along. But then, of course, they got to Soda Springs and had to split up because they were going to go to California and Father DeSmet was going farther north. And Fitzpatrick told them in no uncertain terms, you don't want to go there. You're going to die in that desert, or you're going to perish in the mountains, but you're not going to make it to California that way. You should all go to Oregon, and you can winter over in Oregon and go to California in the spring if you want to, but it's a death sentence to go out there. And half of them took that advice and did go to Oregon. But the other half, about 32 men, one woman, and a baby, took the route to California.
That's what amazed me. Here's a woman, a little baby, and every one of them made it to California except the guy who accidentally shot himself.
Yeah, and that was back on the plains. That was before they split off. Nancy Kelsey was the woman. She was married to Benjamin Kelsey. She was 17. She had baby Anne with her, who was about a year old, I think. And she was riding a horse part of the time, and then by the time they were in the Sierras, I think she was walking. But she made it. She made it. They all made it. It was amazing.
I'm talking to Nancy Leek. Her book is John Bidwell, The Adventurous Life of a California Pioneer. And I think, Nancy, one reason that your book, if I want to call it reader-friendly, that you've considered the reader's experience when you're writing this book, is that you have spent so much of your life with books. I mean, your undergraduate degree and you did graduate work. Where did you go to school?
Oh, I went to Berkeley. I was an English major. Then I went to library school at UCLA and I've worked at a variety of libraries and I've taken time off to be a mom too. And so, yes, I am familiar with the kind of books that are being done for children now. And that's the kind of thing I wanted to write, one that would be interesting, accessible, have lots of good stories in it, have some good pictures, the maps, all
well,
of that.
When John, so we've got John Bibble going across the plains. He finally gets to California, but it's not California. So we can't really say he's gotten to California. It is California. But it is not a part of the United States. So he has to get a passport when he gets here.
Yes. He got to Marsh's ranch. He didn't think much of John Marsh. He called him the meanest man in California. He had to go to San Jose to get a passport. The passport was signed by Mariano Guadalupe Vallejo, another famous name in California history. He first had to spend 3 days in jail before he got the passport. And then everyone said, you want to go join up with John Sutter. Because the Mexicans had mostly settled along the coast, along the Mission Trail. The interior, they seemed to be happy to have given a huge swath of that to John Sutter. And John Sutter had this pretty grandiose ideas about building an empire in Central California. And he needed men of all kinds. He needed fur trappers, he needed vaqueros, he needed farm workers, he hired a lot of Indians. But he didn't have someone like John Bidwell. He didn't have someone who could read and write, keep accounts, and survey. John Bidwell had taught himself surveying, and that was a very important skill at that time. And he went all over the state doing maps for people of their land grants. And one of the first assignments Sutter gave him was dismantling Fort Ross. Sutter had bought Fort Ross lock, stock, and barrel from the Russian Fur Company, who were getting out of California, and he sent Bidwell over there to take it apart, ship things by boat, you know, down to the bay and up the river, drive the cattle across the plain or across, you know, California. And Bidwell took care of all that, spent most of a year, I think, at Fort Ross, and then coming back, traveling back to Sutter's Fort, he left his horses, traveled across the river to the fort by canoe, came back, and the horses were gone. The horses had been stolen. Well, he was determined to get his horses back. So he and Peter Lassen and I think an Indian guide headed north looking for these fur trappers that had recently gone through. And he got up into this part of the country, Chico Creek. He thought it was gorgeous. He thought it was beautiful. It was just exactly what he had been looking for.
My guest is Nancy Leake, and we're talking about John Bidwell, a book she has written about the adventurous life of a California pioneer. And he is on the scene when all these things are happening. He gets to California. He fights in the Mexican War. And then, of course, the reason people want to come to California is maybe there's gold here.
You know, it's funny. He was working at Sutter's Hawk Farm down there near Marysville. And one of the workers said, you know, I've been up in the hills. It looks just like gold-bearing land in Mexico. I'll bet you anything there's gold up there. Oh, well, let's go take a look, says Bidwell. And he goes off with this man, Pablo, and they take a look around, and they can't really find any gold. And Pablo says, what we need is a batea. Bidwell doesn't have a clue what that is. He had learned Spanish, but that was not a word he knew. He got the idea it was some sort of complicated contraption that they were going to have to send to Mexico for, or maybe even go to Boston to get built.
That's why I'm laughing, because he might have discovered gold sooner if he hadn't been caught up on this language problem,
Yes. This
word batea, which he thinks, well, I don't know what that is. Gosh, we're going to have to travel. Again, he was willing to travel long distances if he had to.
And couldn't seem to explain that it was simply a wooden bowl for washing the gold, just like a gold pan.
So John Bidwell, he gets gold, and he also opens what's called Bidwell's Bar, which is not a saloon, but a place where people, he meets a lot of people there in his establishment there.
Well, Bidwell's Bar was the the town, because a bar was just a sandy bank or island where they would prospect for gold. And so there were a lot, there was Rich Bar and a lot of places that were called something bar. He had discovered gold there, so it was Bidwell's Bar, and he opened a store there. And I was fascinated in the State Library to look at his ledger book from 1849. And I reproduce a page from it in the book because I wanted people to see, you know, what things cost, how much sugar cost, how much flour cost. He sold brandy, he sold whiskey, he sold picks and pans and pants.
We might notice that this was before Annie Bidwell, so he was selling whiskey.
Oh, long before Annie Bidwell, yes. And he made a lot of money mining gold, and he also made a lot of money out of that store.
Well, because he was a sharp businessman. But people also recognized his leadership qualities. So when they needed to elect people, there was a line, though, that he was too nice a guy to be elected to public office.
Well, he was elected a state senator, and then he was also later elected a congressman. But he ran for governor four times. I mean, he ran actually twice, and twice he ran for the nomination, for his party's nomination, and he never got it. And in 1867, when he ran for governor for the party nomination, the Union Party was dominant in California at the time. The Republican Party was also called the Union Party. And he was sure he was going to get that nomination because he was highly respected, he was well known, and he probably would have got it, but he wasn't willing to deal. He wasn't willing to bargain. And largely that was because of Annie's influence. At exactly the same time, he's courting Annie by letter, and he wanted to shine in her eyes. He wanted to be, you know, this moral giant. He was a highly responsible and moral man, very straightforward, very honest. But he probably, before Annie, he probably would have been willing to make a few bargains in order to get the nomination, you know, because it was typical then, it's typical now. You promise this for that, for votes. And he wouldn't do it. And so he lost the nomination. And he was kind of, I don't know whether he was bitter, but he was angry because he had his ambitions. He wanted to be governor.
He wanted to be governor. President, he ran for president too, but that I didn't get the impression he really wanted to be president.
Well, he didn't really have any expectations of being president when he ran on the prohibition ticket. Although he got more votes as the prohibition candidate than any other prohibition candidate ever got. So he was known nationwide as a very, you know, upright man.
Thank you, Nancy Leek, author of Biographies for Children.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.